Hello, back again. Welcome to the fourth panel. My name is Tobias Haberkorn, and I'm here with Gerard Lofvink, Hannes Bayor, and Felwyn Sarr. So after sites, protocols, and different modes of attention, we'll now speak about the imaginaries of contemporary literature and contemporary publishing. This is a very general title, and I think we'll take up discussions from yesterday, from this morning, and we'll see what our speakers will present. So we will start with Hannes Bayor. He is a writer and literary scholar based in New York. Among many other things, he recently completed a PhD on Hans Blumenberg's language theory, but given his CV, this must have been only a small part of his time in the recent years. So he is a writer and a theorist, and together with Gregor Weichbrod, whose talk we've seen yesterday, the founder of the experimental literary collective OXOA, so you can see a lot of his work online. Recent, only from 2016, work includes an experimental novel called Durchschnitt, volume that he edited called Code and Concept, Literature and the Digital. And he's also, not the least, the German translator, together with Swantje Karich, of Kenneth Goldsmith's Uncreative Writing, and I think it's going to be published very, very shortly with Mattes on Sites. His talk today is called, entitled Publishing and Publicing, and you have the word, Hannes.
Okay, thank you. It's Svante Lichtenstein, actually. She's the co-translator.
Oh.
She was very active in introducing conceptualism to the German literary scene, so she deserves a lot of credit. I'm here in my capacity not as a writer, but rather as a scholar, and maybe not so much as a literary scholar, but rather picking up on something that I worked on before, namely the concept of the public. And I would like to talk about and expand on the concept of the public under the conditions of the digital. So the idea of this talk is really to talk about how we can conceptualize publicness in a digital age. And maybe it's more sociological or philosophical than literary, but we can talk about all of this. What I'm presenting is very much a work in progress, and I really appreciate your input. I'm testing out ideas here, so please criticize away. I know that the concept still is rather weak and has a lot of points in which you can attack it, and I invite you to do so. So the basic question I want to talk about is, what does it mean to be or to make public when everything is already public by default? And I try to make a very simple point, and I could sum up this paper in four words: public as a verb. So we all can go home now. I will try to explain what I mean by that. So public not as a noun, but as a verb. Not so much as a place, and not so much a relationship, but rather an activity, if you will, a performative interpretation of the public. So a little background, how I came to this topic. A couple of years back, I worked on Hannah Arendt, or Arendt, really depends on the language, and specifically her idea of the public sphere. And Arendt is important for this concept because she was one of the first, after Dewey, in the 20th century to really theorize the public, and is also very important for what Habermas later did with the concept. Arendt is also interesting because her concept of the public is very puzzling. It is almost unusable today in a way because it relies so heavily on the Greek polis that it's already incapable of dealing with traditional media publics, even less so the internet. But I always found that friction very productive. More specifically, I come to this topic through my work about digital culture and what I called infra-thin platforms, that is, publishers that mostly publish on the web, specifically Gauss PDF, if anyone of you know them, or Trollthread. We had Tegel Media here. So things like this, Fiktion, I think, belongs also in this category. These are publishers that do not necessarily produce books, but rather texts online, PDFs, etc. Sometimes they can have books, but these books are usually produced by print on demand. And what is important about this is, because the print-on-demand service is also accessible for every single individual person, these platforms do not do much more than any individual user could do themselves. So what do they actually do? What is it that they add to the mix that makes something more public, or public in a different way than if I do that privately? If I upload something to a server or upload a PDF to lulu.com, if you don't know it, you should have a look at it. And it is also a reaction to what Florian Kramer said once, that the difference between private and public writing is erased on the internet. And I don't think that is true. And these platforms like Gauss PDF are a very good example of this. Finally, I'm trying to develop an idea by Alessandro Ludovico, who coined the term the publishing gesture. So the publishing gesture is something that is done by these platforms. And I would like to think about what else we could do with this topic. So these are the reference points: Arendt in the public sphere, the problem of publicness by default, and Kramer and Ludovico. And I think maybe it's also useful to connect all of this to some other discussions we had. I'm thinking of the term editorializing that Marcello talked about yesterday. I don't have a presentation, so I will be what Gerald Raunig called a boring presentation. I will just read the paper, but the paper is printed in the reader. So if you like, you can read along. It's on page 227. All right. Hannah Arendt's The Human Condition, the foundational philosophical text to theorize the public sphere before Jürgen Habermas described its structural transformation, paints a doubly dual image of the public. It is both distinguished internally and externally. Externally, the public sphere is defined in contradistinction to the realm of the private, which acts as its enabling condition. A public sphere, according to Arendt, is only possible in the first place because we can emerge from the private and step into the public. So for Grecophile Arendt, and she takes examples from ancient Greece, we come from oikos to polis, or from household to the marketplace, to the agora. Internally, the public sphere is divided into its material and its immaterial elements. It is made up of the intangible relationships between humans founded in action. So this idea that action between humans itself creates a public sphere is important for her. However, these actions take place in the concrete material site. So we have the same problem that we had yesterday, that we suddenly have these two ideas of space, relation, a relational space and absolute space, connections between people, and some of the container model, the model of architecture, the model of a place, a space where people actually meet. But I would say that it's in its most basic, Arendt's public requires the physical proximity of human bodies. So she even extends this reliance on the material to the actual locale and even architecture of the political encounter. For Arendt, then, the emergence of a public sphere is bound to physically present people gathering in a material place. Together, they create what she calls a space of appearance. This space is predicated on the act, as I said, of leaving the private and entering into the public. So obviously, this model is flawed, but I think it is a useful starting point to show the problem with the concept of the public as we face it today. This model is flawed because the distinction between the private and the public, and between the material and the immaterial, has lost much, not all, but much of their meaning under the conditions of the digital, of the internet, or at least have become highly ambivalent. And this was already part of something that Arendt criticized. Already Arendt herself deplored the fact that the clear separation between public and private was in retreat in modern capitalism, and she called this all-permeating amorphous new realm that mixed private and public sphere the social. She understood this term to mean the public organization of the formerly private matter of subsistence. So the oikos, and we have the term economy from oikos, household, becomes a matter of the polis. So yeah, the household is a matter of the state now, and this is something that she criticizes. Today we may have, you may be forgiven to have a different association with a category of the social, and really, just as a trainers association, it is social media that explodes the private-public distinction, and maybe even networked communication in general. Arendt, of course, could not have foreseen that the internet would exist or would reduce the internal distinction between material and immaterial aspects of the public. Yet since the 18th century, and this is a criticism that has been leveled against her forever, since the 18th century, the public sphere has increasingly relinquished its material character, from the reading public of the Enlightenment to the listening public of, for instance, Roosevelt's fireside chats. Today, under the conditions of the digital, it can seem that we have entered an era of almost pure relationality, in which the public is no longer bound to a specific site, nor even to uniquely material and object-like media like newspapers or books. This is problematic to say in this extreme way, but let's go with this for a second. So this makes Arendt's dual difference, which still has relevance for other things, for instance, for the bodily assemblies like Occupy that Judith Butler recently talked about. This makes this difference appear misguided for discussing the de facto standard of the public sphere today, the internet. And we can discuss how far this notion of relationality is actually true. I mean, Marcello talked about these two layers interacting with each other yesterday. Arendt's fervor for distinctions is, however, useful because it allows us to make two observations. The first is that in the digital, the residual separation between public and private has indeed not collapsed into the social, rather that the social realm has assumed publicness as its form. Now, the social realm, by which I mean most of the things we do on the internet, has assumed publicness as its form. So under the conditions of the digital and the ubiquity of network communication, most of our representations, utterances, and actions, since they are potentially accessible to everyone anywhere, are public by default. Even if they are private, they're public by default, even if they are private. Real privacy, if available at all, is only secondary, and it's the deprivileged option. And I mean by that two things. The first one is structural and technical. Publicness is the pragmatic norm of the internet, or at least the web. That is, it is the imperative that is inherent in its technical structure. It is precisely its point that whatever you put on it is accessible to anyone, everywhere. But more narrowly, I also have things in mind like to be publicly accessible is the default option on many social media sites. So the privacy settings on Facebook, for instance, are public by default. The same goes for Twitter or even a personal blog. Whenever we want to opt for privacy on these things, we need to take an additional action. So this is public by default. Now, further with the observations, on social media, private users engage about intimate matters, about private matters, in front of a potentially world-encompassing audience. Even places like dating sites containing highly private information are, by virtue of their general accessibility, part of this global public sphere, I would argue. Users do know this, but they are, on the whole, unperturbed by it. And you notice this, that even post-Snowden, I don't think that people necessarily have paid much more attention about their privacy setting. It's rather a kind of resignation that has set in. However, users adapt to this fact of constant publicness, or of publicness by default. And this is the second observation. Internet users have found ways to re-inscribe the difference between privateness and publicness into this default publicness itself. So the need to mark some utterances and appearances as public and others as private, even if both are in principle accessible to all, anywhere, at any time, is a basic social competence of today. It's just something that we do, and by we I obviously mean, you know, people who use the internet. This is a limited we. The act of entering into the public and creating the creation of a space of appearance, to use Arendt's terms, are still felt to be necessary, And in the absence of its material representation and its concomitant default status, however, the public may now have shifted onto the level of a performative simulation. So my thesis, and it is obviously very speculative, is that in the digital, the distinction between private and public today is no longer bound to particular institutions or identifiable spheres, but rather it has shrunk to gestures. And when I say gesture, I will not define the term. I try to leave it as open as possible. All I will say is that I don't just mean speech acts. Gestures can be all kinds of things. It can be non-linguistic markers. So there are two interpretations of this phenomenon. The first is where publicness is the default, it is marking as public and not making public that becomes central. So marking as public, not making public, because everything is already public. Second, and a little more speculatively, where the public as such is no longer a place, as Arendt had it, it may itself reside in the gesture that makes public. So that one could speak of doing public rather than going public. So the ramification of the first interpretation, marking as public instead of making public, are most visible, most directly visible in the traditional realm of making public, that is, in publishing. The public sphere has, for Jürgen Habermas, mostly existed as a publishing sphere. However, where publicness has taken over, publishing may appear too ubiquitous to register anymore to the audience of the default public. This is what I mentioned before. If you just put something up on a server, it's not necessarily public in the same sense as something that has been published. So we see the sentiment in media theorist Florian Kramer's claim that in the age of homepages, in the age of homepages, blogs, and social networks, the classical distinction between non-published personal writing and published writing is moot, and with it, the distinction between everyday communication and publishing. End of quote. I believe that Kramer is correct in identifying publicness as the default condition of the digital, in which publishing has become a matter of course. Yeah, we publish every day. If you write a tweet or write something on Facebook, yet. What he fails to note is the distinction that even where everything is public, not everything has the same potential significance to count as published, even if it is public, right? This is the idea, whatever I put online not necessarily has the same status as something else, and this obviously goes against kind of the techno-utopianism of the 90s and the hope of the internet as being the great egalitarian unifier, that everyone now has access to the public. In Arendt's Greek ideal type, the public sphere and the private realm were strictly separate, so that it took courage to cross, quote, the gulf between the sheltered life and the household and the merciless exposure of the polis, end of quote. At least when it comes to our digital lives, for some of us at least, and increasingly so, because this is obviously a generational gap and a generational development. People grow up with these things and it becomes more normal. So for some of us, no such gulf and no such step that crosses this gulf exists anymore or exists less and less. Since in many ways we live in the public, we often cannot bring something into the public and publish it. Rather, we have to gesture toward its status as public and stress or reaffirm its publicness. And Alessandro Ludovico has explained how digital publications mimic traditional publishing by performing a, what he calls, publishing gesture that give it legitimacy. So for instance, an experimental digital publisher like Gauss PDF or Tegel Media or Fiktion CC does nothing that its authors would not be able to do themselves, namely to upload a file to a public server, but it nevertheless stages the work in a way that marks it as published, even if its publicness does not depend on it. Gauss PDF acts as an infra-thin agent that conveys publicness to a PDF by performing this publishing gesture. So it enacts a set of conventions, still derived from traditional publishing. So the books have a cover, they have a colophon, or even just the fact that there is an intermediary between writer and reader. That makes no one mistakes this public publication from a private publication, even if this private publication is public, that is, accessible to all. However, what Ludovico overlooks is that this gesture is not at all bound to what is traditionally called publishing. In fact, these gestures permeate all online conduct, since it has to negotiate default publicness with the marking of something as public or private. This is why I think it would pay to extend this concept. So instead of the publishing gesture, I suggest that the term the public king gesture. Public king goes beyond publishing. It can pertain not only to works, but to any act, image, role, practice, or framework that we want to mark as public. So all publishing is publicing, but not all publicing is publishing. By the way, public king exists. It has not been used since the 16th century, but it's in the OED. It used to mean publishing. So it is obvious that a publication issued by Random House is no less public than one by Gauss PDF, but publicing also happens on the individual level, I think. I public when, for instance, after having shared a photograph of my cat on Facebook, I share a link for this conference. This might be a matter of contrast, but the idea is that both the photograph as well as the link are publicly available. Something happens when I publish this link to the conference that marks it as public. And this is why I like to talk about the gesture, because it's not actually quite clear what happens there. So this reaffirmation of something as public can, I believe, hide in the most minute factors, which may not register with anyone but the publisher. For instance, when I rename a file in a GitHub repository, which is an online repository for programmers, you can upload your scripts there and make them accessible for all. When I rename a file in such a repository to make it more comprehensible to a reader, this can imply publicing, I would argue. To renaming a file to make it more accessible to people to understand what it means is a type of publicing, because I have a public in mind. Similarly, to spell check a tweet could be a type of publicing, especially if you normally don't do that. So I believe there are different degrees of publicing, and we know this from everyday communication. So writing in an official or stilted style is obviously a type of publicing. The GitHub example is less obvious, but I would argue that it still counts. Conversely, one could say that there's something like the privating gesture. So my posting a cat picture might be a type of privating, even if among its receivers there are people I don't know personally. The already mentioned dating website often relies on privating. The proverbial torso picture on OkCupid, for instance, that is a picture that doesn't show the face, but a naked chest, usually male. So this torso picture, which omits the user's face, is most definitely a privating gesture. Sometimes even a certain platform itself can be a type of privating, and I'm thinking of Grindr, for instance, which is admittedly locally because it's GPS-based, but it is public nonetheless. But at the same time, it is privated due to its context, and I think there is a whole sociological layer and historical layer specifically there. So, of course, this distinction is not perfect and not always clear. Paradoxically, some privating gestures could be reused to public. So I, for instance, may hope that my cat picture makes me more relatable. And politicians, for instance, do this all the time. PR works like that, too. So there might be a limit to the usefulness of these concepts, but I think they show how people are dealing with the increasing ubiquity of publicness, public as a default. So again, what does to be or to make public mean when everything is already public by default on the internet? And my answer is you mark it as such in a certain way, and this in a certain way is something that is open to interpretation. So publicing and privating are ways that publicness and privateness are gesturally reinscribed into the default public. However, and here finally come to my very short second interpretation, it is also possible that this default publicness, because we don't have it yet, This is an extrapolation. We obviously still have a lot of privacy. But it is possible that this default publicness may become realized and lose its meaning over time. And under this interpretation, we will no longer wonder about our relatively recent shift towards publicness, because that shift will be complete, and thus we will no longer perceive it as unusual. And this is a term that Hans Blumenberg likes to use from Husserl. It has entered the life world. It no longer registers. In this case, and especially in the face of its material absence, it would be possible that the public itself would become a gesture. That is, in other words, to create the infinite difference that designates something as public in a space that, by virtue of its technology, always already is public, and thus is no longer public in a conscious way, would then itself be the creation of publicness. So the gesture would be the public. Gesturally, one could say with Arendt, we would create a space of appearance in which temporarily a public may emerge. At this point, we would no longer enter a public, and performing the publicing gesture would no longer only reaffirm publicness, but rather we would do public. So now one can speculate about how realistic this notion is. It is admittedly a bit of a dystopian notion in which all of our conduct is accessible to all, and I think a lot of science fiction thrives on this idea. But nonetheless, it is a logical extreme of what I've said so far. So these are, of course, speculations, but in the face of the ever-increasing publicness that the digital brings about, there are good reasons to shift one's attention from publishing to publicking. And instead obsessing over public, over making public, we may well prepare for a time in which doing public becomes the norm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Hannes, for this very dense talk. We'll take two or three questions, and then later on after the other talks have a larger discussion, but please.
Thank you very much for this beautiful presentation. I agree on almost everything you said. So I totally agree on the fact that public is a gesture, but I do not agree, and you can guess it, about the fact that it is not a site or a space. And this is for the reason I was explaining yesterday. I mean, and I think we should think otherwise what we call materiality. If we think about materiality as a capacity of resistance instead of something you can just touch, a force. So gesture is a way of producing a space. Space are always about gesture. And I mean, I think it's very important, it's not just a speculative thing, because the political issues linked to this are very, very important. I mean, a format instead of another one grants some condition of accessibility which are different. And so in this sense, software is very hard. It determines in a very material way how you can access something. If you publish something on Twitter, if you publish something in PDF or in HTML, it's not the same thing. Actually, so I completely agree that changing a name is publicing, as you said, but it is also creating a space. So these platforms of which we are talking about are not only make the gesture in the sense of an immaterial sense, but in a very material one, for instance, creating API to access in a standard way contents or using standards instead of others. And I mean, the Kindle space is not public publicated as an HTML space. So I think this issue of materiality should be rethought, and I don't think that opposing sites and gesture is the right way to do that. But
should I? Okay. Thank you very much. Yes. I'm aware of the limitations of this concept, and I think I don't know if I would agree about the notion of materiality. I mean, as resistance, we would have to talk about this. It makes a lot of sense when you say this. I mean, although you probably would have to explain to me in detail how changing a file name has a material aspect to it, and especially how it creates a space. In that case, I would
in a search engine. For instance, how it is indexed in a search engine. Mm-hmm. And that is in which place of a list which is written and hard written mm-hmm. on a mm-hmm. hard disk. It is changed. Its very place is changed, and that is kind of an inscription which is very, very material. Which mm-hmm. you cannot actually when you deal with an algorithm, you cannot change its behavior. It is rigid. Mm-hmm. In this sense, I mean, material is right, something which right. is rigid and
which again is a relational question.
You cannot just say, I interpret it in another way. No, if it is the third, it stays right. the third. You know, it's
right. Although this is already an understanding of space, I think that makes a couple of assumptions, right? Granted, I agree. I think I also wanted to say that this notion of publishing, I tried to limit it to basically to the web and to because you come into a lot of problems once you try to extend it, especially if you try to extend it to the interaction between offline and online. You can ask what is the difference to social roles. But for me, it was really the understanding that publicness as accessibility makes certain demands. And these demands are met on an everyday basis. So this is just observation about how the behavior of people changes once these things are introduced. And much of what I describe relies on private companies, right? So Twitter, Facebook, Grindr and OkCupid are all privately owned companies. This is another thing that I think has changed a lot over the, especially from the understanding of the web from the 90s to now. So there is clearly a political aspect to this that also would need to be addressed, right? But this is basically what I would answer to that.
Danny.
Thank you, Hannes. This is great and so much to think about. I wanted to push on the limits a little bit because it seems like such a useful rubric. I wonder how you might think about something that's a hybrid public-private gesture. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking in particular of publishing something under a protected password website publishing a... Is that me? That's lovely. It's a nice soundtrack. Okay, I'll roll with it. Publishing, for example, about an enemy on Facebook whom you have blocked, that everyone except for who you're publishing about mm-hmm. can see, or indeed the kinds of hand-to-hand transmissions that one might have with guarded torrent communities or private libraries like Geertz, right. For example, which are in a sense they're published objects, right? That are published with the character of having a private dimension right. as a kind of exclusionary mode of publishing. Mm-hmm. I wonder how that would fit into the right. the schematic that you developed.
I think that there are probably two answers to this. At least one would be that obviously there are multiple publics. All theories of public sphere, at least all of them that make a bit of sense. Understand that there can be overlapping and intersecting publics. That there's no transnational public. That's only one, etc. This still relies a bit on the assumption that the structure itself determines the use. This is probably a problem. But I would think that you could solve this by going maybe away from the technical structure and actually bringing it to the title of this panel, namely imaginaries. That publicing is always happening with a public in mind, so that publicing itself might create the audience. Let's not say the public, but the audience of that public, which means that you could clearly do this also in a hybrid situation between private and public, where some people are excluded, but others are not. But these who are not excluded constitute that public toward which you act. So this also means that this is clearly a historically and socially shifting concept.
Okay, thank you. We'll take one more question and then I think we...
Thanks, Hannes. This is a very stimulating notion of publishing. I'm just wondering, we are discussing of this notion of publishing since yesterday, but to my mind, publishing is also a symbolic gesture. It is framed mm-hmm. within a symbolic imaginary. That's why we have proposed this term of imaginaries. For instance, recently a French economist has proposed a theory of publication. Maybe you know Olivier Bomsel, you know this theory, which is quite interesting. It distinguishes two phases in the publishing process, the phase of accumulation and the phase of what he calls monstration, display. We could say display. Mm-hmm. And this phase of monstration is always anticipated within a frame. For instance, for literature, we could say that it's because you are framing your accumulation depending on the novel, the poetry, or the theatrical piece that you want to write, mm-hmm. that you are envisioning this kind of imaginary. He states as well that this frame is to be thought within a hyperframe. Mm-hmm. For literature as well, it's not exactly the same thing to find a book of Proust on bookshelves or on Amazon. So he tried to state a kind of poetics of this symbolical transformation in publishing. Mm-hmm. So is there for you a kind of imaginary of publishing with maybe this same poetics, depending on the frame, the hyperframe, mm-hmm. you can imagine when you public. Mm-hmm.
I think it's quite compatible. If I understand you correctly, maybe what's missing in this is the hyperframe, is the idea that it is not only an imaginary that is created, and I understand imaginary here the value and the anticipated value of the symbolic gesture,
yeah.
That this itself is still framed within a maybe historically more rigid frame, like something like literature. Is this correct? I, to be honest, have not reached this point, but it seems to me like a very useful way. And I mean, obviously, a lot of different things and regimes interact with this gesture. And I mean, it sounds like a useful addition to this. Or maybe it's better if we just use this.
Thank you, Hannes. I suggest we maybe come back to more questions. If you have questions, keep them in mind, and we will hear the two other speakers first, and then we have a broader view, maybe. So now I'm happy to introduce Geert Lovink on my left, who is a media theorist and activist from Amsterdam. So Geert has, since doing his PhD in the 90s, I guess he has... which was called Dynamics of Critical Internet Culture. He has worked on this thing that we call internet culture, and that maybe tends to become more and more our everyday culture now, as a matter of fact. So Geert is probably familiar to you as one of the most prominent internet critics or internet theorists. He is a professor at Hogeschool van Amsterdam, where he also is running... and has founded the Institute of Network Cultures, about which he's going to present in his talk. I will just cite out of a long list three of his most recent publications. We have from 2013, Unlike Us, Reader, Social Media Monopolies and Their Alternatives. Then The Money Lab, Reader, An Intervention in Digital Economy from 2015. And from last year, Social Media Abyss, Critical Internet Cultures, and the Force of Navigation. So, the floor is to you.
Yeah. Wonderful to be able to share some of our experiments and doubts and strategies and discussions. I agree that there is something wrong with publishing. It's maybe it's a regressive term. Why would we go? We could say in the development of the web, we even go back from publishing to publishing, right? So why would we do that? Why would we make such a regressive step? And a couple of people have come to us and say, yeah, you're doing great things, but we don't consider our work, as part of publishing. And so there is something to you know, what Hannes just presented, and there's something, you know, more to it that needs to be thought through. And I just want to point you at a very recent move to bring the EPUB standard to the World Wide Web Consortium, which seems to be a move away, a response of that particular community to this problem. And instead of, let's say, bring the World Wide Web to the EPUB, we, of course, need to be doing the reverse, right? We need to bring the publishing back into a much larger, even technical framework. So I thought this was an inspiring move for me, and one that has you know, long-term implications for many of us here. And it's a move that I absolutely endorse, and I think it's very interesting to re-establish the discussion between the engineers, those who discuss the protocols, and those who are now working in this subsection called publishing or web publishing. Anyway, there's a lot to be said about that. I want to just say that very soon I'll be back in Berlin to present Social Media Abyss in a couple of weeks. So I want to continue that conversation. It's great to see that there are, again, many, many collaborations between us and people here in Germany. And we want to call everyone here, if you are interested in collaboration, please contact us. We're very, very interested in being part of a consortium, publishing your work, sharing ideas, and so this is the book. It's came out last week in German, and in German it's called "Im Bann der Plattform," which I really love. It's a great translation. So I think the translation is superior to the somewhat not so superior English original version. So, and by the way, my last book in German was translated from German into Spanish because I said the English one. Well, forget about it. You know, this is, if you want to go to the essence of my work, the essence of my thinking, you need to you need to translate it from German. So yeah, I'm very, very happy with this. So who knows? We might see each other in a couple of weeks. Okay, yes, MoneyLab was mentioned. We're working on the second reader. There's a lot of collaborations happening there. It asked the question of internet revenue models in relation also to publishing. We know it's early days, but you know, in terms of internet development, it's never too early, right? So let's be speculative, let's speculate, and you know, ask ourselves the question, how are we going to make money with digital publishing experiments in the future and bring these things together, right? I have to say, in Amsterdam, we try hard, but we haven't really, you know, made the crucial connection yet, but MoneyLab is our big project at the moment, and the question how precarious authors, designers, programmers, and so on. Yeah, in Holland, 30% is considered precarious workers. Right, this is a considerable part of you know, the creative underclass. We need to have the money, the income question on the agenda. Right, and we are now in the middle again of a cryptocurrency hype, right? So this is the Bitcoin hype. In the MoneyLab agenda, there are also other elements that we talk about. the role maybe of universal basic income, which is important because maybe we cannot resolve this economic question out of the technology itself, that maybe the technology itself is not going to tell us how we're going to make a living, right? So there is no technical solution or no solutionism, if you like, quoting Morozov, for that economic question, right? I want to look into it, but you know, there's a lot going on in this field, and the internet is now increasingly becoming a platform for this. It's not only one player, but increasingly, you know, playing a very, very central role in this, and Bitcoin and the cryptocurrencies, but also crowdfunding to some extent. Anyway, it has many, many facets, so I'm not going to give a money lab talk here, but I do want to say that this is very, very much on our minds. And it is associated with this first publishing activity of our institute. So when I came back from Australia, started this initiative in Amsterdam, we started working with this publishing house, the Netherlands Architecture Institute. In Rotterdam, it's the only place in the country where you know, they have a really good international distribution when it comes to English titles. So yeah, it was kind of a natural partner. However, we ran into very serious economic problems with them, right? And increasingly, this is the case, and I've heard a number of people here mentioning it. These days, individual authors for monographs are invited to pay anywhere between 10, 20, or even 30,000 euros if they want to publish a monograph. Yeah, this is insane. We have published in this series about 6 or 8 titles. The last one was Florian Kramer's book. And after that, we ran into austerity and into the global crisis, and we couldn't afford it anymore, you know? And this is a problem. So digital publishing is running into these same problems, and this time it is done under the somewhat Orwellian name of open access. And we all know what this agenda is about, right? It's about individual authors having to pay in order to publish something on the web. And this is insane. I need to address this because everything that you see after this is in a way a response. Is a response to that economic crisis, a reality for individual authors who are definitely confronted with this. So when we're talking about the open web and so on, you know, this is also done with this academic madness, in our minds, because we cannot continue with that, in my understanding. We cannot feed the Elsevier beast. We have to stop this, and this has to come also from collective action, because right now this is a problem of individual authors. They are approaching us, but you know, this has to come to an end. It can't continue like that. Anyway, so there is an economic urgency behind you know, the things we're discussing here over the last 2 days. Simultaneously, we started this this format, and then we tried to understand. Okay, so what we're doing is developing new formats. New formats or existing formats, and this is somehow what we're still doing in the form of a series. So, of course, experiments are good, but we like experiments and repeat them, and then just see if you can learn something from it, because a lot of the experiments done, especially in the artistic field, they're very often one-off things. And we find that the nice thing about publishing is that you kind of do it a couple of times, and then you find out about it. This is the same with these, for instance, these anthologies. As I said, we produced about 12 of them. The most recent one is the new one of MoneyLab. And the good thing about that is we're expanding the range of the different platforms. So one of the pilots there is really to have this kind of a diversity of the delivery platforms. Just also to find out, because not so many people of you can find out, publish something, and then, you know, distribute it over 5 different channels. That's, as an individual author, that's quite a lot of work. Why would you do that? I don't know how many of you, for instance, publish on Kindle, for instance, yeah, or something like that. And it's got a lot of readers, who actually takes that step? Part of that is also for us to now start doing our own podcast series. So the audio publishing is in a way becoming part of it. Before we experimented with robots reading our books. And as you know, you can just send your text file to a website, and then it returns an MP3 version of your book. That's fun. It's fun thing to do, to figure out, to see, if people like it, will they download it? I always imagine, people driving on these crazy highways in Canada and the United States being completely bored and then listening to our books. That this is somehow... or somewhere commuting, I don't know where, in Japan, on the metro, something like that. Okay, so this is what you can do with your books. But you know, does it work? Okay, you can do it, but does it make any sense? Does it have any? Can we get some response? Is there any improvement there? What does it mean? Are you again part of that iTunes cloud? Is that really what you want to do? Okay. The most successful series I want to just stay with that for a while is the Theory on Demand series, and this is the kind of the follow-up of the first one I showed. Right after we said, well, we can't afford to pay all this money to a publisher. We said, why don't we do it ourselves? And this is our print-on-demand series, now quite successful, number 24 already. We get a lot of stuff at the moment. So here we really see that we're kind of on the verge of becoming a publisher ourselves, even though that was not our attention so much. This series is now doing so well we're confronted with that question. You know, where does the experiment stop, and where do you become a player in the field? And there's, by the way, a couple of us in this environment who are kind of between the chairs, but at the moment, small or not too small anymore. Okay, that's the same with this series, a new one from last year, which also has a lot of potential. This is our response to Medium.com, which was started, of course, by Evan Williams, who was one of the founders of Twitter.com. Medium.com, at some point seemed to have some kind of pseudo monopoly on the long reads, on the long form. But of course, that's not the case, because why? Nobody can claim that. So why don't we again? Why don't we start our own, long read series? The long reads in our discussions, in our definition, are the somewhat longer standalone essays between 4,000 and 7,000 words. And they look like academic journal papers, but of course, the unique thing about Medium.com, but also our approach, is that they are standalone essays. They are digital objects, which of course the academic journal has a problem with, because often they're software-wise, they're inside an environment, a firewall, and so on. But also sometimes, conceptually speaking, the article is part of a theme that was suggested by a journal editor, and so on. Right? The long read is really a standalone piece that fully thrives and survives through its presence, through its circulation on the social media, right? And that maybe that's also a really, really different approach in comparison to the academic journal article. Imagine if academic journal articles would fully circulate on Facebook only, right? I mean, yeah, it's hard to, in fact, very hard to imagine that. But why not? Why wouldn't there be, a very, very large and thriving social network in which that knowledge would circulate instead of being locked up? Okay. A while ago, we wrapped up our first phase of this research into this publication, the Digital Publishing Toolkit, and then we turned it into a separate organization, and that's called the Publishing Lab. I know it's a bit confusing, but the Publishing Lab is the place where people from all over the world, students, come to do internships and to work with us. So if you are interested in that, please look at publishinglab.nl. Okay, now I want to just go into a couple more experiments, and then we can discuss. Of course, there's the 3D Activist Cookbook, which was in fact presented here a while ago at Transmediale. Which I think is still quite an astonishing piece of work, a collaborative piece of work. Lots of artists. It's one of the first e-books that has fully integrated 3D images, but in a very, very interesting and subversive, just a very, very stimulating manner this was done. So we were very, very happy and proud to be part of that publishing experiment. Of course, the book is somewhat heavy. I forgot how many gigabytes it is, but it's incredible. It's a bit heavy, but then you get a book with 3D images, right? Okay, the first, probably one of the first in the world. Last week we did another experiment, and this is a somewhat bigger Dutch architecture theory book. In the tradition of, let's say, Paul Virilio, but also Kohlhaas and many other, let's say, the Delft architecture theory tradition. This book was translated into English, finally, by Wim Nijenhuis. We were very happy to work with the publisher, 1001 Publishers. And this is an interesting, because you buy this book, so the paper version you buy, but you can download the EPUB for free through us. So that it's that kind of collaboration, also to transfer the experience, to share that with publishers, but also just to see, how this could work out economically speaking. And here you see one of the pages of the EPUB. So, now we come to a close, and that is also that we started to do crowdfunding ourselves. So that's an interesting point where the money and the publishing started for us to come together. So this is one of the possible futures where we look at models like Patreon in this case, where authors are paid regularly, right? Where people no longer give money through crowdfunding, but where we introduce subscription-based payment systems. And Patreon is really quite far into this. Okay, I want to close now with the research proposal that we are developing. I want to share that with you here. We're going to submit it right after the summer. And this is our, let's say, our next stage for the digital publishing research that we're doing. To sum it up, is that what we are, what we want to do is that we want to further look into the question of speed, for instance. It's been said yesterday and today by a number of people, the ease with which you can do the digital publishing when you do it yourself or together with others that assist you in this. We want to further investigate that idea. So where, for instance, where speed is fast, does it mean that if you have high quality and high speed, that, for instance, the exposure is rather limited? This is often a presumption. Or when the quality is high and the speed is low, which is traditional publishing, as we know, and especially in America, right, with up to 3 years for a monograph. And Americans are complaining a lot about that. So these are the different models, and this is what happens when you start to change these parameters. Okay, I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Geert, for this for giving us an overview of this vast variety of activities, and also for pointing out, I think, economic and political issues that haven't been discussed a lot so far. Maybe we take a few reactions, questions, also from the larger public, if there's... Okay.
Hi, Geert. Thanks for the talk. You mentioned the idea of a Facebook for academic papers. Sort of made fun of it, but actually these it does exist in various shapes. So there is academia.edu, which is still self-managed, as far as I understand. There was the Social Science Research Network, which has been acquired together with or after Mendeley by Elsevier. These repositories go back to archive.org, so with an X, the original physics and mathematics preprint repository. So just an idea from you on these repositories. Also maybe in respect to the three dimensions you've mentioned last, because speed in publishing, of course, was the original motivation for establishing these ease of publishing and speed for these repositories.
Especially for research, yeah. I mean, maybe in arts and humanities, the speed is not so relevant, but definitely when it comes to medical discoveries, it's sometimes, vital. It can save lives of millions of people, so... More and more people are convinced that speed, when it comes to publishing, apart from the peer review aspect, which of course could potentially slow down it a bit, but I'm interested in that, but especially. If you liberate the research from its context, which I say, when you turn it into a digital object, that's when it really picks up the speed. If you don't have to wait, let's say, for another volume of a journal that has to come out, why would you? When the research is important, why would you wait for something? As trivial as that. Pre-publishing, there's a big culture nowadays of pre-publishing. There's mixed experience, of course, now with academia.edu. I have definitely withdrawn from that when I started to realize, their... their business model, and I didn't agree with that, so I bailed out. But in general, there is a flourishing culture at the moment of pre-publishing, and from which you could say, this is actually publishing of the digital objects, mm-hmm. to use your term. I'm quite in favor of that. Whether these are social networks that have their own dynamics already comparable to Facebook or others, I doubt. We've been with INC since 2011. Heavily involved in the discussion about the alternatives for the social media platforms, and this discussion really had its ups and downs. And I don't want to say that I'm skeptical at the moment. It's just that we have faced so many setbacks, and I would love to report at that level. About progress one could make. One of the good things about digital publishing is that it's a relatively small environment where small groups like us and similar groups across the globe can make a critical contribution. And that's a good feeling. That's good for the, you know, for the collective motivation. When it comes to solving the big question, you know, do you have an alternative for Facebook? And I'm asked this question almost every day, right? People ask this, and journalists ask this, but also the general public ask this. I don't say they demand it, but yeah, that question is on the table, and I can only say that's much, much bigger than the context we're talking about here.
For the time being, Facebook is being used by a lot of academics.
Yeah,
and in fact, it's an interesting question because the functionalities that it offers, if you use groups and if you are connected with relevant people in your field, is actually, and this is why it works, unfortunately, you might say, so well, is that it is still very functional and it's free to use with a lot of downsides, of course.
But it doesn't offer any collaborative tools and so on. So on. I mean, anyway.
Okay, we had one more question or reaction, and then we move on to the next speaker.
So, how much do you think about, or what would you say about how much these new forms of publishing and financing the creative work, how much they have an effect on the content or what can be written or what? Because I, for example, now when I go to the Patreon site, so it says your most passionate fans will then finance you. So that's how much the content will need to be steered towards sort of very effective kind of content production, if you understand what I mean. So do you see that this changes also the game in a way that we need to have different kind of contents in order to seek the attention? And
sure. Well, I can distinguish between two models. One is, let's say, the crowdfunding model of Kickstarter, but more precise and better example there is Patreon. On the one hand, what happens there is that this is a form of pre-financing. And with that, it's kind of comparable to those who say, well, you know, I have a script of a film. I'm looking for the money. Here's my script. Please give me money, and then I can realize the film. Then in that case, the creative work, what you are referring to, has already been done, more or less, because the script has already been written, right? So, and this is the downside of that pre-financing model. Of course, there's the other model, which is much more looking, digital payment systems for content, which you pay afterwards. And then you more or less have complete freedom. The question how you're going to finance the production of it remains unresolved. But in the other model, you get paid afterwards. And we are interested at the moment, for the time being, in both, because we don't see where where it's going or what could potentially be the best model. Because for limiting the creative ideas, the pre-financing maybe is not so good. It's the same as writing a proposal and then going to the publishers, right? It's quite similar. You have to pitch and so on. Awful. But then you have money to produce it. Whereas in the other model, it's completely open. If there's any group that is of readers or watchers, you know, who's gonna like what you make and who's going to reward you, the fact that people are going to pay more for content for us is more or less a given. So we have the Google, Facebook model of the free economy is more or less in a crisis. And there's many, many people who, you know, who agree with that, even the big players themselves.
Okay, there's maybe more to discuss later on, but I wanted to introduce to the panel Felvin Saar, who is with us from St. Louis in Senegal. And so he is a scholar, writer, and also musician, if I'm correctly informed. He's heading the management faculty at the University Gerstenberger in St. Louis, and he's also the head of the newly founded Faculty of Civilizations, Religions, Arts, and Communications. His research is focused on a wide variety of fields, ranging from economy to epistemology to the history of religious ideas. He's also the author of three novels and a lot of academic publications. His most recent essay, published last year, has the title Afrotopia and has won the Grand Prix of Literary Associations. And he is also a composer and author of several musical pieces, as I said. So today, his talk is entitled Thinking the Present and the Future. You. Oh, if how you prefer. You can, whatever is more comfortable.
So, I would like first to thank Lionel and all the organizers for inviting me in this conference. I'm not doing a performance, so I'm just sharing with you some ideas in a classical way. I'm going to read my, you know, to read my text. And when I've been asked to give a title, I was thinking my thought was in progress, so I give a large title, Thinking the Present and the Future, allows me to put inside all that I want. But now the more precise title is Culture and Imaginaries of Renewal. So it's what I'm going to talk about. So what I'm proposed to do in this reading is to question the culture as a space of production of meaning and sense, but also as an agent of social transformation in the context of African societies, through a work on imaginaries. Culture, through its possibility of redefining, informing, or reconfigurating imaginary, has an impact on reality, its perceptions, and consequently on social practice. So culture in its wide meaning can be seen as a space where the social consensus, the social standard are renegotiated, but also as the place of breaks, renewal, and reorganization. So in my reading, the concept of imaginary will be questioned as well as its relation with the artistic practice. If culture can be defined as a set of sociological or anthropological lines which distinguish a given social group, in this talk, culture will be seen as all the work or reproduction of the spirit requiring creativity in their production, and connected to the education of the individuals and to the production of symbolic meaning. So arts, science, and diverse way of life are in this definition. So for me, culture is a way to explore the reality in all its dimension, but a kind of deep exploration of reality. And the imaginary is the ability of an individual or a group to represent itself, the world, with an association of images which give the world a coherence and a sense. According to psychologists, the imaginary is a central function of the human psyche. And one of the genius of the human culture is the creation of symbolic languages which let the sense be established in a network of images. The French philosopher Gaston Bachelard, leaning on the reading of the symbolism of all human tradition, asserts that our membership in the world of images is stronger and more constituent of our being than our membership in the world of ideas. So the relation between this space of creation that is a culture and the question of renewal, so I will come later why the question of renewal is important for me in the context of African societies, through a work on imaginary will be the main issue I will address. If we look at the African societies or the African continent, one of the main characteristics is that the African continent is diverse. From the north of Algeria to the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa, Africa is the place of a profusion of culture, of peoples, of historicity, of geographies, of social and political organization, of different temporalities. But despite this diversity, which is one of its greater resources, all the nations of the African continent have to face, I think, the same historical challenges. They all share the same recent history, but above all, they also share the project of an Africa that must once again become its own source of light or power. So the multiple challenges in the African space are social, political, economics. And solving the question of the social and political imbalance and answering the fundamental needs for the African people is crucial. But for me, the danger is to be trapped by a thought only based on necessity or biological necessity, only thinking the space of economy or social needs. A civilization does not only run on its material values. A civilization is complete by its spiritual or cultural values, which give him sense and direction. So it seems to me that one of the most urgent challenge for Africa is first to accomplish its emancipation and to build society or civilization which allow the self-fulfillment of individuals and society, but also which propose to the world a rise in the humanity, taking the idea of Frantz Fanon. It often seems for most of us that the most important space to meet these challenges is the space of politics. It's not my deep feeling, and I don't think so. The space of politics is certainly fundamental, managing the city, establishing fair rules of games, sharing the resources fairly, building the citizenships, etc., are devoted to politics. However, the collective psychology, the behaviors, the attitudes, the way of being and acting, the relation to the world, are spaces that are strongly structured by the culture in its extensive sense of space of production of meaning, but also as a space of construction of the humanity with a big edge of women and men. So this power of culture, it can be transformed into an economic value added, and this is the role or the aim of the cultural industries. But this creative strength can also be used as a tool or as a power of transformation and reinvention of ones. Because, in my view, to face the present challenge in the space of Africa, but also elsewhere, and to envisage the future, it's necessary for Africans to reinvent themselves. This is why I've chosen to shape this reading around the notion of renewal, reinvention of one, and cultural transformation. So for me, the culture is a place, is a main place of reinvention of one. The African continent is getting out slowly, but I hope surely, of several centuries of alienation, and the tracks of these alienation are present in the collective psyche. The colonial fact had substituted the former system of production of sense by the Western one, what we call epistemicide, had exercised an extreme political and symbolic violence, and this one has left tracks in the psyche of the majority of Africans, including those who did not live the colonial moment, by the transmission of a transgenerational memory, but also the violence of the post-colonial state that weakened their population by failing to provide to their basic needs, but also some of them by repressing violently their aspiration in more equity and dignity, also left deep tracks in the psyche of the individuals and the African society. Therefore, the necessity is crucial of reconstructing the psychic infrastructure of the African people, the self-respect, and getting out of a painful memory. So the culture can be a space of the cure and resilience. Music and religions, which are art of the participation, can play an important role in this process by offering the possibility of communion and a catharsis, but also the possibility of the transformation of the group in a power to act. As human beings, we do not have with the world immediate relations. Our experience of the world of life is configured by mediation with which build our universe. So the question of how we put in representation the world is absolutely important. A challenging or a crucial location in Africa is to know to what extent the images produced in Africa, on Africa, so photo, literature, movies, plastic and visual arts, can contribute to change representations, to a reconfiguration of the territories of the visible, the disabled, and the thinkable. The cultural production are a space of discourse and representation, and for Africa, they must produce for African a reconciled image of themselves. In this view or perspective, work on the photography, on movies, on the documentary movies is absolutely important. So the renewal, how will come the renewal? If you look at the cultural productions or produce, they articulate a discourse on the present. It echoes existential question, but culture is also a place from where we think the future. The society reproduce themselves in their imaginary space. A French sociologist, psychologist, and economist named Cornelius Castoriadis has done an important work in this field. This one, so the imaginary space, this one constitutes the missing part without which no future is thinkable. A question could be, from where will come the renewal or the revival? My point is the renewal will come only if it emanates from the psychic structure of the community. A deep change will not come through the top by the law, the politics, or the institution. I don't think so. The top can impose an order, but this order is very expensive and his cost is very expensive for the community. If this one did not deeply accept or interiorize this order. So the order by the law is the order that is, it is very costly, but the order produced by a change in the social or the psychic infrastructure of human beings or society is less costly. So all the question of citizenship, of civility, of how to manage the public space are, for me, related to this issue. If we look on African societies and their history, the westernization of Africa is in progress since the colonial time. Official languages, educational system, administration, economic organization, institutions set on the African continent took Western forms. However, the social order are unwilling to completely marry these forms. And the value system which ensues from it is something, there is an hybrid form that is trying to find his way. We notice a disjunction between transplanted institutional forms and mental frames and local system of meanings which continue to produce in diverse space form of organization different from these. So how to accelerate the cultural transformation or how to produce a new synthesis with, you know, these new forms and all the forms that has driven the history of African societies. For me, the notion of contemporaneousness of several words seems to me to describe the contemporary African societies, characterized by a process of political, social, and cultural transformation, an unfinished transition of the former to the new, a juxtaposition within the same society of different temporalities, sometimes even within the same individual, as several reference systems can live, negotiate, enter in a conflict, or inter-fertilize. Some people live at the same time a traditional time, a modern or a post-modern time. The cultural value of a society being in a constant redefining, the African societies are symptomatic of these permanent renegotiation of their cultural references and the transversality of several worlds. There are several regimes of culture in African society, a popular culture which seems to oppose to a culture of the elite, mainly based on imitative and extrovert models, an urban culture of globalized youth consumer of the world culture of mass, tube clips, videos, and Facebook, Twitter, what you want, and a traditional said culture. There are also relationship of power inside the groups, which often end in the imposition of a dominant culture by the elite. However, in several individuals, culture is a palimpsest, compound of various layers, borrowing from diverse universe of reference, and therefore a culture can be viewed or considered as a space of a project, the place where we produce and articulate the form to come, the forms that are arriving, the form of living in society, of political institution, and so on. So, from an African perspective, the Africa we want, or the world we want, so we can enlarge the objective. The civilizational project, which is ours, the scale of value on which we decide to build, the place that we grant to the humanity of the woman and the man, the content which we give to this humanity is a project which takes place at first in the space of cultural production, and it's my point. So the artist or artistic practice are the most advanced observation post-Laffine. Culture as a laboratory of creativity, synthesis, and renewal can be seen as a space of imagination of the forms to come and the way to live in these new forms. It is a place of the expression of the face of the human experience which we carry, and the ultimate ambition is to enrich the human sensibility. The fourth, the literature, the music, the painting, the visual arts, the movies, the television series, the fashion, the folk song, the architecture of city, are space where are shaped and configure the form to come for the individual and social life. The world of tomorrow is in germ in this one, and its signs can be seen or guessed in the present if we look carefully. The African literature constitutes for the contemporary period an important archive of the cultural history of the African countries. Born in the 1930s, she became a space of a cultural and political claiming. She played an important role in the expression of real life experience of Africans, their existential questioning, and their political ideas. African writers register the real-life experience of the African in the symbolic landscape of the word letters and claim the expression of imaginaries and experience grounded in the real-life experience of their people and their culture. Their writings update the concerns, the idea, and the latent form of the real-life experience of their societies. So the African literature also gave a spot to disqualify disaster of a post-colonial situation by imagining counterfactuals or different words. Music and fashion are also space where the genius in the creativity of the form of the African and their ability of synthesis, recycling, reshaping, express themselves. The African stylist and musician had neither without drums nor trumpet, but by creating an Afro-contemporary aesthetics, drawings from the local sources and digging into the forms who came from outside, they solve the question of the cultural synthesis, and I think in a harmonious way. In this space of a cultural synthesis or production, the Africanity is a movement which no predecessor could not define once and for all. Africanity in this space is a syncretic, and its only task is here to produce beauty and functionality. I will end with the idea of change and imaginary. In the historic factory of change, the role of an imaginary of emancipation is crucial and fundamental. The event, or what we say in French, événement, is most of the time recognized after blow, but his meaning is established by the discourse. If you look at carefully, before all kind of revolutions, the metaphor of revolution is always present in the artistic discourse. But also, the imaginary of commitment and distance is fundamental. It allows a reflexive distancing with regard to the reality. Art can be seen as a reflexive strength and then an emancipating strength. It authorizes the utopia, the another place, the place that is not here actually, which tears the weft of the time which aims to be unchanging and which allows to glimpse it something which does not still exist, and especially that we can prefigure. The world is to be create, recreate, and to be perfect always. There is a renewed genesis of any things. Eternal in completion of the forms require their constant reinvention. Any society, any culture or civilization transmits a cultural matrix through the time, but by transforming this one according to the evolution of the society or the world. Fabien Ebossi-Boulaga, and I will end with that, that is a Cameroonian philosopher, indicates that it's by culture that the human being made themselves a genesis as autoproduction of one from what he is in the direction of what he is not yet. My point and my last point is that the deep revolution is always a cultural one, and it's in this space that we have the privilege and the responsibility to act. So thank you for your present attention.
Thank you very much, Felvin, for your talk. So now we can take specific questions first for Felvin and then also larger questions for the entire panel. Lionel.
Thank you, Felvin. Tobias, in your introduction, you have not mentioned that Felvin is also a publisher, I guess. And maybe I want to focus on this question because I have the feeling that you and Achim Mbembe and Wayne Aina, who cannot be there, unfortunately, are now major actors of a change in Africa because not only you are writers or musicians or philosophers or hence producing a specific imaginary for Africa, but you are also producers of public spaces, communities, and in your case, you have established a publishing house, and you have launched this gathering of African thinkers under the name of Les Ateliers de la Pensée in Dakar. My question, Felwin, is about this different imaginary, these different contemporary imaginaries you're dealing with, because as a scholar working in a university, as a writer publishing mainly in France, and now as a publisher, maybe you're more oriented on the Western apparatuses of production of meanings. So how can you, Felwin, combine these different imaginaries? Just a quick note, but Achim Mbembe, 2 or 3 days ago, was speaking at the French National Radio, and he was saying that in politics, in most of the countries of Africa, people believe in spirits, and spirits are created communities. Believing in spirits create communities. And if you don't want to take account of that, you can't propose a new political imaginary. So in terms of culture, you see what I mean?
Yes. It's a very important and deep question. Firstly, I think that young African scholars, most of them are produced by various geography, various historicity, and different epistemology. We are at the crossroad of different libraries. I was born and raised in Senegal, but I have done my university in France. And after that, I came back to Senegal to teach at the university. I've lived 15 years in France, between 20 years to 35. So I think it's a very important time in the constitution of my, you know, my personality and my intellectual grounded. But also, I was raised in Africa. It means that the African libraries, the orality, my culture, is also a part of my library. When we are called Western, you know, thought, it's not very, it's incomplete, you know. People forget that before we came in, you know, in the University of the Western, our society, our culture produced knowledge, epistemology, and, you know, and sense and meaning. So we are in the crossroads of these worlds, and we are most of the time circulating. So we are inside and outside. We are inside and outside. And it's from this place that we are trying to produce a new imaginaries of Africa, a new discourse on Africa. Also, as a scholar and as a musician and as a writer, I'm also, you know, in the crossroads of different disciplines, and it allows me to try to have a kind of transdisciplinary sites, but in a practical way, just not in a theoretical way. This last year, transdisciplinary is, you know, is the key word, but in the reality, it's very difficult to have a transdisciplinary researches. You know, even if you have a transdisciplinary laboratory, there are logic in the academy that are very difficult, you know, to knock out. And yes, so what Achille said last 2 days ago is that Africa can be actually seen as the laboratory of the new world that is coming for different reasons. And I believe that. Firstly, Africa is not deeply engaged in the industrial world that is our world. And Africa, we can see the limits of this project of society. Africa have space, had a demography, very good one. And Africa have to reinvent the equilibrium between ecology, economy, culture. And the idea of who is the member of the community is very important. Actually, it seems that in Europe, there is a crisis of solidarity. Europeans don't know how to deal with the migrants. In Germany, they've done a huge effort, but in France, in other countries, they don't want to handle this question. Who is the member of the community? It can be, yes, one man, one vote, but it can be the spirits. It can be also the nature. We can enlarge the vision of the community to the nature and give rights to the nature, like they do in Latin America, in some countries. So the democracy, it can be the democracy of the living, just not of human society. And the way people act in their ecological space, grounded on their culture, the way African society had succeeded to accept the plurality and the diversity, diversity of gods, diversity of name. In the African traditional religion, you will never find an episode or a time of war, a religious war between Ceres religion or Jola religion, because in the space of the religion, all the gods are accepted, and people add their identity. It's not having alternative identity. So you can gather different identities. So I think that in all these topics, we can mix various imaginaries and produce new imaginaries that is a synthesis. And I think that the synthesis is going on. It's a deep process. It's going on in the daily life of Africans. And probably the anthropologist or the social science researcher have to keep this sense that is being produced in social interaction and put it in a theory. It's not very difficult if they accept to, you know, put down the Western epistemology sometimes and look to their society with new eyes, or if they accept to do the effort of producing theoretical concepts or humanities that are grounded, that are, you know, that are looking more precisely what is produced, what is the meaning, the production of the African societies that are always producing sense, but we always want to see the Western signification in these spaces, the Western vision of what is modernity, of what is society, of what is the democracy. And it's for us an important and a huge task to renew the tools through which we are trying to read the social dynamics. And our idea is that we will fail to transform African society if we didn't understand deeply the African societies. And the first task is how to understand more deeply the African societies, and a getting out of what Valentine Mudimbe called the colonial library.
Okay, thanks. More reactions, questions, ideas? Then I can maybe ask a question, because you were emphasizing the big diversity as one of the characteristics of Africa, both on a geographical, demographical, cultural level, all over the continent, but also in different African nations. And so in a way, this cultural diversity also represents the diversity of publics, of public subspheres in a way. So maybe also relating to especially Hannes's talk, where Hannes, you were presenting, like, speaking about the default public as the default setting, so to speak, of everything that becomes public. But in a way, maybe the diversity of the situation in Africa, but not only in Africa, kind of questions this, because of course all the publics are fragmented. So do you think there is a certain technological maybe condition that needs to be met in order to bring forth this process of renewal, reinvention you were emphasizing? Is that, like, how is this something that can happen in different fragmented publics, so to speak? Or do we need to think, to conceive of, maybe to construct also technologically a larger public? Or is this idea maybe a regressive one, because it's coming back to the idea of the elitist public sphere that has been constituted through Habermas and so forth in high culture? What's your thoughts on that?
Most of the time in the African space, they intellectuals are always criticized, because one of the most important criticism is to say that, okay, it's very interesting what you are doing, your kind of job, but and how can you talk to the various spheres and to the people? They don't speak your language, firstly. You know, you have official languages that are different than the language people talk, and they don't have access to your epistemology or your conceptual framework. So for whom are you talking? It's just the minority of the elite, or what? It's the main criticism. So because that we are criticized on this idea, so we have thought about it. I have thought about it a lot. And one of the ideas is that if you look at African societies, they are grounded on what we call orality. It doesn't mean that in Africa there was not a script, but the writing didn't play the role of a transmission of knowledge that he play in Western countries. People transmit knowledge by language, by discourse. And there is a technology of how to transmit to the next generation's knowledge through orality. African philosopher named Mam Moussa Diagne has worked on this topic, and he has found the idea of a oral reason, and he tried to understand what are the processes. So one of the challenge is to disacademize, to put out of the academy the knowledge, and how to do it, and how to translate. Translation is very important, how to translate some ideas and some concepts, firstly in African language, but the second in the orality schemes. It's not the same thing that, you know, reading a text or producing an oral discourse. So there is a work to do on the former and on the media. And there are people that are trying to translate the constitution in songs, in hip hop, in various way, you know, to spread the ideas and the message by taking into account the audience. So this is a way of trying to do so translating in the language, but translating also in the formats and from writing to orality, and from French English to Jola Worof.
Maybe just to add to that, do you think that this is sort of a top-down process that can be implemented, so to speak, through cultural policy? Or is it something that will kind of emerge from the different segmented spheres themselves, you know, these practices of appropriation of, do you think this is a process that can just happen by itself, or that should be kind of, maybe you need both, good cultural policies that are aware of these dynamics, and yes, also bottom up.
Yes, dynamics. I think that we need the two dynamics, but for me, actually, it's important to have a top-down, politics on that, to create the dynamics and the incentives. I think that things can take a lot of time if it's just a bottom-up dynamics. In the sphere of artists, and especially in the sphere of hip hopers, they are trying to link, their work with academics and trying to produce a space where these kind of dynamics can exist. But I think that, from my view, the cultural public policies are very important in this moment of this historical dynamics.
Okay. More questions maybe also from the larger public. And of course you can also address the other speakers. Yeah.
I have a question to the former speaker.
Can you wait for the mic?
It's concerning the... Sorry.
Because we're streaming, you have to...
Yeah, it's concerning the economic viability of the work you're doing in the broader field of network culture. Do you know of anybody who's doing theoretical work or practical experiments that go beyond the two models that you stated, which are crowdfunding, of course, and digital payments? Anybody addressing that deeper? The question being, of course, the financing of cultural production, and that includes the arts, but not exclusively.
Okay. Yes, I mentioned it. This is the discussion about universal basic income. Because, this is, for many people, something that's coming up on the horizon, right? It is in recent past, it was completely utopian and crazy. And now, people are associating it also with automation, with the coming of robots, with the necessity for a wide rethink of a redistribution of wealth in a serious way, maybe even in an automated way, right? So
it's a bit like default income for default public, isn't it?
Yeah, well,
in the sense that everybody is producing public contents, that why shouldn't...
Yeah, I would not have said that, maybe a couple of years ago, but definitely this is for us becoming a third option. And, it has a lot of problematic sides, dark sides as well, knowing that, it's also part of a certain agenda in Silicon Valley The people who push this, they're quite diverse. But then again, there's a very big, extremely right-wing libertarian faction within the Bitcoin developers. And then there is a very big, anarchist and socialist faction too, in the same community, if you like. And they are both working on this big issue of the architecture of the cryptocurrencies. And so the fact that these concepts, that they are contested from the inception, not from the implications later on, but in the very model, so that there is a contested, maybe even public sphere within the concept itself. That is something that we have to maybe start living with, because the discussions about what we call, the network architectures, is important. And are the politicians going to do that? No. Funny enough, then nowadays we ask so much of engineers, for instance. I would love if we could ask that to the philosophers or artists, for that matter. But your question is a... Yep.
Well, you talk about contestation, about are the politicians going to do this? I mean, especially in the case that you mentioned before, academic publishing, I would say 90% is just illegal. And this is very effective, right? The Elsevier and all these major academic publishers who have monopolies and make a lot of money by not paying people. All of this is actually happening. It's being circumvented by repositories like ARG or Monoscope or Sci-Hub, which is even one step further than this. So, I mean, I'm only observing this. I don't have any solutions, but I think the non-legal, the extra-legal spheres have actually... there's where the creativity is in this at the moment.
And they've grown substantially. But I really would like to join, to ask many of you to join this debate, because we can see that the era when everything was given away for free is coming to a close, and the contributions of artists, philosophers, programmers in this field. It's going to be really, really important. So the integration into the larger publishing scheme is only a couple of years away, I would say.
Okay. Hello, yes. Are there more questions? Yeah.
Yes, I have a very broad question for the three of you, but also larger, perhaps, and very naive, perhaps. It's the relationship between existent communities and the communities that could be created by publishing or publicing. I was very surprised by a paper of Jean-Philippe Warren of Concordia University. He was studying the reception of translations, and he was noticing that in a statistical point of view, there is quite no reception of certain translations from French to English in Canada, actually, because the author is in a Francophone community and is known in his community, her community, and then when you publish a translation, it just falls in the empty because there's no reception on the other side. So it doesn't target an existing community. So my question is kind of, what is the relationship between existent community and the possibility of creating a new one? So it's a new spaces, perhaps, of aggregation via the publication is there, how do you think it in from a publishing point of view, from the point of view of existing African communities, and then what you can do from a cultural production point of view, and in the other side, more on the scholarly, perhaps, point of view for Gert case?
I don't have a direct answer to this, but I could assume that on the one hand, maybe some creation or the extent of creating communities might not be possible. So that we just have to deal with the fact of a variety of publics and maybe see a value in that in itself. Because the idea of one ubiquitous public is a kind of a regulative ideal that in itself might even have some problems because it's somehow flattens differences. So maybe some of these things are not even necessary to think about them. And then, isn't translation itself already an act of creating a public, a potential public? I mean, it's already one step that. And as every publisher knows, can be extremely unforeseeable how these things work. So it's always an attempt. Whether this attempt falls on fertile ground, you very often cannot say. But that does not make the attempt in any way useless, right? So I think the attempt itself is already a step in that direction.
In Africa, just two points. One of the main issues is how to make circulate African imaginaries in the world space, because we are in asymmetric positions. You know, the Western imaginaries and all are full in our spaces, and all kind of scientific production, you know, poetic, literature, sensibility, that are produced in African communities that are not translated or not published stay in our space. And probably translation is a solution, but in translation there is always asymmetry. It's not the same thing that translating from the Wolof to the French or the English, or translating from the French to the English or the English to the French. If you translate from the English to the French, you can have a good reception if you are a scholar. It's not very evident. So if you look at this problematic in the African context, it's more deep. Some African publishers had tried to fill the gap. A friend of mine, a Senegalese writer named Boubacar Boris Diop, is actually translating a classical of world literature in a Wolof. Jean-Marie Le Clézio, you know, Victor Hugo, and also translating the poetry of Aimé Césaire in a Wolof, because his idea is to make the space of Wolof a space that can, you know, hospitality, accueillir, how we say, host, you know, all these imaginaries. It's a good idea for me. But our main concern is how to translate out imaginaries in the world public space. And a French philosopher named Barbara Cassin has thought about what she called the untranslatable. You know, it's not just a question of translating, but it's also a question of the context. How do you translate the cultural context of a production? So it's a question, actually.
Okay, thank you, everyone. We need to take a short break. And it will be a short one, because then we have still we will stream or just show François Bon's lecture performance. He unfortunately couldn't come to the conference. So we will start with this screening. Let's say, what time is it now exactly? Okay, in 15 minutes, which is 16:50 sharp, we will start with this video screening. And we will also, after François Bon, have Continent presenting first results for Radio Brouhaha, I guess, yeah, sound collage.
Yeah,
but they say to me that it's an environmental sound, which is going to be streamed at the bar.
Okay.
It's not here, I guess. It's in the bar.
It's in the bar, okay. Yeah. Then we can have...
Yeah, and then another announcement for the speakers. There's a dinner at 5:45 at the... Olga?
At the restaurant Auster. So it's from here, you go past Hirschfeld Bar towards the river, basically. And there's a table reserved for the speakers. So 5:45, or 6 is fine too, but it gives us a bit more time if we are there early, so that we are back in time for the radio show at 7.
Yeah, don't forget, radio... is airing at 7 in the foyer. Okay, see you later.
The last thing I wanted to stress is that he has published 6 or 7 years ago a book entitled after the book published by Les Éditions du Seuil in France, which is, to my mind, one of the best books ever written on the new conditions of literature publishing, and it's a shame that it's not translated into English or into German, but if you can read French, I really recommend this reading. So he has sent us a video. It's mostly in French, but with English subtitles, but very minimal English subtitles, partial English subtitles. So it's better to understand French, but if you don't understand French, you can grasp the minimal subtitles.
And you will also be able to watch the video outside in Hirschfeld Bar, so you can also walk around having a coffee in your hand.
Notre difficulté comme notre meilleure chance, c'était justement d'écrire, travailler, transmettre dans l'intérieur d'une mutation. Des mutations de l'écrit, chance, parce qu'il y en a eu très peu. De la naissance de l'écriture, les évolutions intérieures à la tablette, de la tablette au rouleau, du rouleau au codex, codex à l'imprimerie, et directement nous. Et tout ça, c'est bien connu. Vous connaissez l'apparition du livre de Lucien Febvre. Mais est-ce qu'on n'a jamais eu besoin de se préoccuper d'en étudier les transitions? Non. C'est ça notre problème. Dans l'intérieur d'une transition, rien possible de projeter vers l'avant. On doit toujours réapprendre à interpréter notre présent, non pas depuis le passé, même si le passé est là, mais en réinterprétant le passé avec les paramètres que nous réapprend en permanence l'instant et le présent. Ça fait 30 ans que j'ai un ordinateur devant moi. Ça fait 20 ans que cet ordinateur est connecté à Internet. Ça fait bientôt 10 ans que j'ai un iPad, un Kindle. On dispose déjà d'une micro-histoire. Cette micro-histoire, elle nous apprend qu'au mesure qu'elle se fait, on n'a jamais compris en direct ce qu'il fallait comprendre. On comprend toujours rétrospectivement. Voilà, ça c'est le contexte. Qu'on a tout à réapprendre.